From the studios of 2RPH in Sydney, this is 30 Laps with Dick. I'm Richard Lyon. Welcome. Well, this week, the debut of the fastest clerk in history, a true motorsport member or royalty, as you would say. Petula Clark? No. She sounded the best. Peter Russell Clark? No, he tasted the best. Manning Clark? Well, no, he read the best. Clark Gable? No, wrong again, he looked the best. Terry Clark? No, close though. His horn was the best and the sweetest. A wonderful trumpet. No, it's the great, the fastest, the humble, the extraordinary. Jim Clark, this week, 30 laps. Also from a couple of weeks ago, Hooked On Classics, K-Tel, remember them? Well, here's some classics that we all love to hate. So we catch up with that this week in 30 Laps. But this week, we start with an article by Joshua Dowling from Drive.com on the 16th of April 2021. The last Ford XR6 Highway Patrol turns in its stripes. Rest in peace. The Ford Falcon XR Turbo has reached the end of its run as a highway patrol car in Australia, after almost two decades of service across four generations of Falcons. The final example, a marked sedan attached to Surry Hills Highway Patrol near the Sydney CBD, handed in its stripes on the 31st of March 2021, after clocking up 86,156,000 kilometres over 4 years. It was one of the last Falcon XR6 turbos put on the road by the New South Wales Police in late 2016, not long after Ford's Broadmeadows production line fell silent in October that year. The vehicle is photographed with the call sign Central Metro 232, but it was recently changed to City East 212 and a revised call sign allocated across the state just prior to retirement. Unlike Highway Patrol Ford Falcon XR6 turbos used in other states, New South Wales mandated larger Brembo brakes for the high-performance FPV F6 turbo Falcon for safer repeated stopping performance during emergencies. The XR6 turbo used by Highway Patrol and other jurisdictions ran the same undertone brake package as regular Falcon taxis after Ford made some cost-saving measures in its later models. Based near the Sydney CBD, the last Ford Falcon XR6 turbo did mostly short trips rather than open road driving, and so it did not reach its retirement mileage. However, it had to be grounded, as it was more than 4.5 years old and was reportedly starting to show its age. Most New South Wales police cars are retired after 90,000 Ks, or 3 years of service. However, during the peak of the coronavirus pandemic in 2020, some vehicles were ran up to 120,000 Ks, and over time, because they were on border deployments and replacement vehicles were slow to be delivered and prepared for duty. In the Holden versus Ford era, New South Wales police typically had a 50-50 split between the two badges to hedge their bets in case one brand was stuck by a recall. With the final Ford Falcon XR6 turbo no longer on highway patrol duties in New South Wales, it leaves about 6 dozen Holden Commodore SS highway patrol vehicles across the nation. The majority of the remaining Holden SS Highway Patrol vehicles, about 55 as this article was published, are still patrolling New South Wales roads, with the last not due to be retired until later this year or sometime in 2022. Victoria Police told Drive it had already retired all of its Falcon XR6 turbos and just 14 Commodore SS sedans and wagons currently remain in the state. There is one anomaly, however. Victoria Police has, for the time being, held onto one Falcon XR8 Sprint attached to the Road Policing Command as a halo vehicle. However, Vic Pol says the XR8 Sprint is not operational, even though it was fully equipped for service, in much the same way as New South Wales held onto a Ford GTF as a community engagement car. The Victorian car is one of two XR8 Sprint Specials deployed by VicPol in late 2016. The other XR8 Sprint used by VicPol, a particularly partially marked yellow slicktop without roof lights, was wiped out in a crash in 2016, not long after it was put to work. Meantime, police in the Australian Capital Territory advised their Highway Patrol last use a Ford Falcon in 2013. Detectives in the ACT ran an unmarked non-turbo Falcon XR6 until it was retired late last year. The ACT currently has three Holden Commodore VS, VSS Redlines, one SS and one SV6 still in service. These will likely be retired during 2022, a statement from the ACT Police says. Police in WA told Drive they have a handful of non-turbo Ford Falcon XR6 sedans remaining on the highway patrol fleet, but the state hasn't run a V8 Ford or Holden for about 20 years. Queensland Police told Drive they retired all their highway patrol Falcons and Commodores last year. Authorities in the Northern Territory say their records show they did not use the Falcon XR6 Turbo or XR8, but they do have two Holden Commodore SSs still in service, both of which are due to be retired at the end of this year. Highway Patrol in the Northern Territory have switched to the Kia Stinger, along with police in West Australia and Queensland. However, once the Kia Stinger reaches the end of its current planned production run a few years from now, it's just had a midlife facelift, it is not expected to be replaced, having become yet another victim to slower than expected sales amid global shift away from performance sedans. Highway Patrol in New South Wales and Victoria currently use a mix of BMW, Volkswagen and Chrysler vehicles. Their counterparts in the US use high-performance SUVs, such as the twin-turbo V6 Ford Explorer and the V8 Chevrolet Tahoe. In Europe, traffic police primarily use a mix of BMW 3 and 5 Series sedans and wagons, X3 and X5 SUVs, Volkswagen Passat sedans and wagons, and the Passat apparently is favoured for its roominess. 206-kilowatt turbo engine, all-wheel drive grip, and ability to house a full-size spare tyre are a requirement for some agencies. In the UK, high-performance Skoda Superb Sportline, a twin under the skin to the Volkswagen Passat, is also used in some jurisdictions due to its potent 206-kilowatt turbo engine. From the VW Golf R. And we thank you for Joshua Dowling for giving us that little bit of information about what police cars are constituted around the world, but particularly the retirement of the last XR6 Turbo from the New South Wales Police Highway Patrol. From drive.com.au.
There's a kind of hush all over the world tonight. All over the world you can hear the sound of lovers in love. You know what I mean, just the two of us and nobody else.
Well, when you're dealing with a 60s legend, as we're about to, we might as well have music from another 60s legend. And we move now to Motorsport magazine and Jim Clark's racing debut, The Birth of a Legend. And this was written by David Finlay and originally published in 1996 in the magazine Motorsport. Standing on a piece of the dull Aberdeenshire countryside, shivering against the wind as it blasts off the North Sea, you might not at first realise that there was anything of particular motorsport significance going on, or the ghost of one of the most remarkable careers in racing history was whispering around you. More fool you then. This is Crimond Airfield, just beside the village of Crimond and about halfway between Fraserburgh and Peterhead, on what used to be called, jokingly, the Ice Cream Road. In the days when you bought an ice cream in one town and bet your friends that it wouldn't have started melting by the time you drove to the other, a feat requiring very high average speed. This, which is why the Fraserburgh Peterhead Road is now called Gatso Intensive in Scotland. Hard driving at Crimond is confined nowadays to the stock car track, which takes up about 5 square feet of an airfield ground. Doesn't sound very big, does it? 40 years ago, an enthusiastic rider had more room to play with, since the perimeter roads were used as the basis of a 2-mile circuit on which Aberdeen and District Motor Club regularly held combined race meetings for their cars and bikes. These events are largely forgotten now, but one of them occupies an important place in the sport's history, because it was at Crimond in June 16, 1956, that a future world champion, Jim Clark, competed in his first ever circuit race. Although only 20, he was already making a name for himself in club-level rallies, auto tests and sprints at home and in the borders. One of his closest friends on the competition scene was fellow farmer Ian Scott Watson, whose unusual DKW Sonderklasse he shared in the speed events, a DWK Sonderklasse, is a competition car, folks. This 800cc three-cylinder two-stroke saloon had originally appealed to Scott Watson because it featured at what at the time was a very rare facility of front-wheel drive, and the version Ian owned in 1956 was his second in what would become a series of 5. As well as sprinting the car and navigating for Scott Watson on a number of rallies, not very successfully, because he was no expert on the maps and could be reduced to a quaking mess of nerves whenever Ian had to make a time-up fast slot after he called out the wrong instructions. But Clark also prepared the DKW at race meetings. Admittingly, this amounted to little more than removing the spare wheel and applying numbers to the doors. But Scott Watson was sufficiently grateful to suggest that he take part in the event at Crimond. The suggestion came about, though, through a combination of chance and subterfuge. Ian would never have considered it for a meeting at Charter Hall, since that was too close to home, Clark's parents, and they hated the idea of their son taking up circuit racing. They would have heard about it immediately and made their feelings very clear. And in normal circumstances, Crimond was too far away, about 4 hours' drive, to the north to think about visiting. The abnormal circumstances regarding Crimond, though, was that the secretary of the meetings held there was one Noreen Garvey, a cousin of Clark's, who was keen to see her relative and his friend at one of her events. Ian agreed to enter the handicap race, and since there was no chance, or could there be, of Clark's parents finding out, he quietly persuaded Jim to go out in the sports car event. As far as results were concerned, it wasn't an auspicious day for either of them. Clark up against Lotus 7s and the like in a heavy, underpowered saloon car finished well down. Scott Watson, who was rather shaken to see that in practice Clark was nearly 3 seconds quicker than him within 5 laps of leaving the pits, found that the organisers had also taken this fact on board and promptly handicapped him to smithereens. June 16 didn't get much better after that either. It turned out that Clark wasn't the only relation Noreen Garvey had attracted to Cremond. A number of other cousins were there too, and of course they were very excited about seeing one of their clan out on the circuit. News of Clark's exploits got back to the family home faster than the DKW did, and a reception committee was waiting for the travellers on their return. In perfect fairness, it was really a good-natured grilling, Ian said years later, but I do remember taking the blame and apologising profusely. Not much of a day then, but what did it lead to? Hey, who was the world's greatest racing driver? It's a pretty fatuous question, but many attempt to answer it invariably involves mentioning of Clark's name. It was the Cremond meeting that started the ball rolling. Clark's parents could hardly object to his starting racer when he had already done so, which removed the principal obstacle in his early career. He still needed an opportunity, though, and that was provided by Ian. Clark's performance and practice was enough to convince him that he needn't take competition driving too seriously in future. And although he was an enthusiastic racer, for several years afterwards, his main efforts were concentrating on helping Clark. First by continuing to lend him cars, and later by acting as team manager for Jock McBain's Border Receivers team, which was reformed in 1958, largely as a way of pushing Clark on to greater things. And now, with all that in mind, here we are at Cremond celebrating in a small way that immediately significant race meeting of 40 summers ago. There are 5 of us present, trying to work out the old circuit layout through a maze of radio masts and wishing the wind would please die down. Apart from self and photographer, our party includes David Ross, motoring correspondent of the Aberdeen Evening Express, who was very helpful in providing archive material, and his friend David Simon. These two visited Cremond as schoolboys, but there is an extra significance to Simon's presence since he is an authority on the DKW Sonderklasse and was very kindly brought in his own version along. Well, not exactly a copy, I guess. In fact, his car is a 1961 Auto Union 1000. But apart from a slightly enlarged engine, it is a wide-bodied Sonderklasse with a different badge on the nose. The car Clark and Scott Watson raced at Cremond was earlier narrow-body model, but Simon reckons there was none of those left in the country, and in any case, all Scott's Watson's later Dekes were wide-bodied ones. As a hark back to those days, the Auto Union is more than good enough, and we're delighted to have it here. The closest relative to the DKW on the British market is Audi, which was kindly supplied an A4 for the day. There's a nice tie in there too, because the A4 is of course the model in which Audi are currently doing a pretty good job of trying to win the BTCC, which is the British Touring Car Championship, which Clark himself won in 1964, in between his 2 world championships. With due respect to those mentioned so far, the most important of the 5 people here was without doubt Ian Scott Watson himself. He's taken time out from his occupation of designing timber frame houses to make the trip, and at first he finds it difficult to relate this featureless ground to the old race circuit. But one look along the main straight, which rises evocatively behind the pits before disappearing over the horizon, and it all comes back. A ride in the Auto Union has a similar effect. This was my first time in such a car, and to me, the smooth, high-pitched scream of the engine, like a warning cry of a sewing machine protecting its young, is a new, amazing experience. To Ian, it recalls the days when he would wind a similar engine beyond what should have been its bursting point down the long straights of Cremond and Charter Hall, before hurling it into the next corner and revelling in the fact the damn thing simply refused to let go. It's a pleasant day out, all the more so for being distinctly low-key and informal. Every magic there is to be hidden in the background for now, especially when the immobiliser on the car Ross is testing decides to stay on permanently, and we rather guiltily leave him there waiting for the rescue services to arrive. But when you think about Cremond and his willingness to let his friend race his road car and the work he put into helping that friend progress as a driver and the dominance that friend was later to achieve, the enormity of what Scott Watson did soon becomes apparent. Clark's career was astonishing. To have stood 40 years later on the track where it started, alongside the man who started it, makes me feel both proud and humble. A postscript. As we drive through Cremond on the way home, we pass an old church. Many years ago, the organist of that church wrote a tune named after the village around the words of Psalm 23. The Lord is my shepherd. At the memorial service after Clark's death in 1968, the final hymn, and don't get me wrong, this is probably doesn't mean anything, it's a common enough hymn at memorials, but the final hymn was The Lord is My Shepherd, to the tune of Cremond. And there we have it, folks. That was a wonderful story by Joshua Dowling from Motorsport Magazine. And we'll be doing a bit more on Jim Clark as the weeks progress, some of the races that he was in and a bit more of his biography. He was a childhood hero of mine, and I watched him race 66 and 67 in the New Zealand Grand Prix at Pukekohe, and I still really enjoy reading about his exploits, which we will know much more about as the year moves on. That was a classic. Freddie and the Dreamers. They had a moment right in the middle of that. I've had a couple of moments this afternoon myself reading this wonderful story of Jim Clark's. Here's another classic. 10 classics we all still love of the KTEL variety, but from Chris Rowlands in Classic and Sports Car Magazine. So we'll do a couple. We probably won't get through all 10. We'll have to do some today and some next time. Think that only the best cars are celebrated? No chance. While the greatest motors rightly get their plaudits, plenty of lemons also have sizable fan clubs today. From shonky Iron Curtain cars to British sports machines with suspect build quality, some of the history's least inspiring, most disappointing, and in some cases downright rubbish models have a dedicated following. More than that, a few have achieved full cult status, sometimes precisely because they are so bad, but in other cases simply because they're old enough that nostalgia has turned their faults into characterful traits. Read on, our list of these cult classics follows. Thank you, Chris. We will read on. Starting with A, the Austin Allegro, wildly regarded as the worst car ever to come out of Britain. The little Allegro was plagued by bad build quality, shocking reliability, and handling that you could send you anywhere. Not to mention a woefully inefficient manufacturing process. Somehow, it still sold well in England. What's more, as with so many cars considered rubbish in their day, the Allegro has since become something of an icon. probably because it was so bad. Just as the 2003 film The Room has risen to infamy for its appalling production, so the Allegro, once voted the worst car of all time, is now something of a cult hit, seen most affectionately at a nostalgic distance. Our friend at 30 Laps, the DeLorean DMC-12. Not so much rubbish as just plain average. Though when you're trying to be a sci-fi sports car, that's probably just as bad. Yes, for all the striking promise of its gull-wing doors and stainless steel shell, the DMC-12 delivered middling performance, forgettable handling, and a notchy gear change. All of which did nothing to dent its status as one of the world's most iconic head-turning cars of all time, and one with a very dedicated following. Distinct from the die-cast models and the die-hard fans of Back to the Future, in which a modelled DMC, modified DMC, served as the all-important time machine, there are DeLorean owners' clubs all over the world, all of which proudly celebrate the futuristic, flawed coupe. And that's where we'll have to leave it today, folks. We're running out of time, so we'll do some more very soon of the greatest lemons of all time that are still regarded as classics. So that about wraps us up, I think, today. We started on our biography of Jim Clark today, and as I said earlier on, we'll have some more information about him in the weeks ahead. Some of his wonderful driving and some wonderful stories too. He is a man to be admired. Killed far too early in 1968. And we looked at a couple of lemons, and we'll look at a couple more as the weeks progress. And of course, the last FXR6 Turbo Falcon. The New South Wales police are going to have to find something else, although I don't know if you've seen or heard the BMW's police cars in their fury. They look pretty good. They cost a bit more than an XR6 Falcon did, though, I can assure you. Lucky the New South Wales police has got a lot of money, hey? So we'll have a talk about those in the near future as well. Thank you very much for your time this afternoon. I've really enjoyed bringing you the show. I look forward to talking to you again next week about something different, as usual. Be safe, hey? Take care. Keep that seatbelt on. Bye for now.